At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. And joining me on today's program is Dr. Ryan Anderson. He is the President of the Ethics and Public Policy Center based in Washington, D.C. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Hey, for the benefit of our listeners and viewers today, could you just tell us briefly what the Ethics and Public Policy Center does?
Sure. So we are a think tank based in DC. We're a public policy center that focuses on ethics and public policy. It's a pretty descriptive title there. We were founded in the bicentennial year, so 1976. We've been around for about 45 years now. We're explicitly Judeo-Christian, and we're thinking about, you know, what are the proper moral values, moral principles that undergird a just society, and, you know, what sort of laws and policies should flow out of that. We're dedicated to both America and the Bible. You know, we're pro-America and pro-Bible.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In a similar vein, CPC at the state level is doing that, not on as large of a platform as you are. You know, one thing that comes to mind as we talk about this is there's such a wall between groups like yours and maybe even Commonwealth Policy Centers. When you begin to talk about Judeo-Christian values and biblical principles, it seems to short circuit the conversation right out of the gate. Have you found ways to overcome that? And you're even in a tougher arena than we are. You're in Washington, D.C. How do you do that? How do you overcome that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is using the language of, you know, what in the Reformed tradition might be called common grace, which in the Catholic tradition might be called natural law, is that there's no conflict between faith and reason. There's no conflict between scripture rightly understood and science rightly conducted, right? We're not going to see faith and reason arriving at different conclusions, provided both are conducted properly, right? Philosophy and theology will go hand in hand, provided you have good philosophy and you have good theology. And so I think being able to speak both of those languages, right, and depending on who your audience is, might determine which dialect you use, that's going to help prevent the short circuit that you described.
And yet culture's not there. If you were to ask, I guess, I've not seen any surveys, but if you were to ask the man on the street, is there a conflict between faith and reason? I would guess that most would say, yeah, you know, keep faith in the church. Let's keep reason in the public arena. And that's at least my perception of the mindset that's out there. And I don't know.
Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of truth to that a lot of people think there's a conflict. And so one of the ways that we, you know, address that is by whatever the controversial issue of the day is, whether it's abortion, whether it's marriage, whether it's gender identity. You know, we want to be able to demonstrate that there's no conflict by marshaling the science, marshaling the philosophy, marshaling the medicine, you know, show them the embryology, show them the psychology and the psychiatry, and then the supposed conflict evaporates. You know, it simply goes away once you can give them both the faith and the reason argument.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in the United States, we have a faith tradition that has influenced the public policy formation. It's influenced those in government who hold office. And it just seems that it's in recent decades, maybe more 40, 50, 60 years, that there has been this split between faith and public policy or faith and government. But it is really part of our political tradition, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, like, you can go back to the founders when they talked about the laws of nature and nature's God. You can fast forward to just, you know, 50 some years ago with Martin Luther King Jr. and the letter from the Birmingham jail, where he cites both Augustine and Aquinas to say that an unjust law is no law at all. How do you know which laws are just, which laws are unjust? And that's where he cites Augustine and Aquinas to say that man-made law needs to embody the divine law and the natural law. Right? He explicitly says he appeals to both sources, right? The eternal law and the natural law. And he says man-made law needs to be in conformity with the eternal law and with the natural law. So we used to have that prophetic tradition in American discourse. I think it's only really within the past generation or two that arise of kind of like a what Father Richard John Newhouse once called the naked public square, where you have to banish religious values and religious voices from the public square. That's a very recent development in American public life.
And at the core of anybody's beliefs, anybody's policy proposal, any law, there is an underlying proposition there, isn't there? It could be secular, could be sacred, but it seems that the sacred has been under attack, that the faith, in particular the Judeo-Christian view, has been under attack. I want to pivot to a recent controversy. You published a book a couple years ago called When Harry Became Sally. It tackles the issue of gender identity and transgenderism. And it was taken off of Amazon recently. They totally blocked it in all of the formats of it being obtained. It's a well-researched book. It was academic. I thought well thought through. And yet it was removed. Can you tell us what happened there at Amazon?
Sure. You know, I wish I knew fully what happened. They really haven't told us much. It was about, I guess it was 3 or 4 weeks ago now. On a Sunday afternoon, I discovered that the book had just been disappeared. Someone trying to buy the book reached out to me to say, I can't find it on Amazon. What happened? And I thought maybe there was a technical glitch. So I pull out my app on my iPhone and the hardcover is gone. The paperback's gone. The Audible book is gone. The ebook, the Kindle is gone. I reach out to the publisher. I'm like, did we forget to like renew our contract or, you know, what's happening? Amazon had not reached out to me. Amazon had not reached out to the publisher or the distributor. They simply erased the book from their cyber shelves. And then only weeks later did they give a reason claiming that it violates their content guidelines. Yes. The problem here is that Amazon controls something like 70% of all new adult nonfiction book sales and 80% of all ebook sales. They are the market. And so if Amazon removes you from the market, it's going to negatively impact you, but it's not just about me here, right? Because it's also going to impact the future author who's going to think twice before writing a book that might run afoul of the Amazon censors. It's going to force a publisher to think twice before they publish a book on the controversial issue where Amazon might simply remove it from sale. And then consumers, you'll never even know about the books that never get written in the first place, or books that get removed, but aren't by authors who are prominent enough to kind of garner media coverage of the removal. So it's a really bad development for a culture that needs the free exchange of ideas. And that means the free exchange of books.
I mean, and isn't this an American ideal that we have freedom of speech, we have freedom of association, basic First Amendment rights that would allow people like you and me, for that matter, to publish opinions that are different from the mainstream? But one thing that's not American is to block or to cancel other people out. How do we address, what would be the proper response to cancel culture? Now, of course, you're talking, when we talk Amazon, that's a private entity. I mean, they can decide what they carry and what they drop. But what would you suggest to conservatives concerned about cancel culture? Is there anything we can do? And if so, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, so you're correct in making the distinction between like the First Amendment and private businesses. The first words of the First Amendment are Congress shall make no law. And so the First Amendment really restricts government action. That said, that doesn't mean private businesses can do whatever they want. That's never been true under American law. There are all sorts of limits on our rightful liberties, right? None of our liberties are unlimited. And, you know, we have laws that govern anti-discrimination conduct for businesses. We have laws that govern antitrust and anti-monopolistic practices. We have laws that regulate utilities and common carriers. And it strikes me that an entity like Amazon really sits right at the intersection of those three areas, right? It's questionable, did they violate an anti-discrimination law here? Are they functionally a monopoly and therefore violating antitrust protections? Have they been engaged in consumer deception and therefore a consumer protection law might be at stake? I don't know. We're going to have to find out. Yesterday, the Attorney General of Indiana sent a letter to Amazon requesting more information as to their conduct. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't, you know, say whether or not they've violated current law. I'm looking into it. But I think conservatives should not default to the private businesses can do whatever they want, that the only threat is big government. Big business and big tech can also be threats to our freedom and to our flourishing.
Is the Ethics and Public Policy Center asking Congress to hold hearings on this or to investigate what Amazon is doing? Because it's not just your book, but I think it goes across a spectrum, and particularly with LGBT issues. You have a very active and influential LGBT community that has come down hard against contrary opinions when it comes to human sexual ethics. But what, are you talking to Congress at all or encouraging them to look into this?
Your question reminds me to point out for our listeners and viewers that Amazon made this decision the Sunday before the Thursday vote in the House of Representatives on the so-called Equality Act, right? So the timing is highly suspicious. It seems like they were trying to shut down debate right before a big vote on Congress on an issue that my book discusses, right? And an issue that I've been an outspoken critic of. Four senators have already sent a letter to Jeff Bezos requesting more information of the decision. Just on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, eight members of the House of Representatives from the Republican Study Committee sent a letter to Jeff Bezos requesting more information. And then yesterday, we saw the Indiana AG Act. So, you know, different politicians and state AGs are looking into this. And, you know, we're going to have to wait and see what they uncover.
Ryan, you'd mentioned, we got just a couple minutes here till we wrap it up, but you'd mentioned the Equality Act. Could you share with the listeners and viewers some concerns, some of the top concerns you have with the Equality Act? It sounds good at the outset, right? We all want equality. We want to be treated equally. What are some of your concerns with that bill?
Sure. So look, it's great sloganeering. It was a great marketer who came up with the title of it. Who could be against equality? But here's what it actually does. It takes the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it takes every law that we have that bans discrimination on the basis of race, and then it adds the phrase sexual orientation and gender identity. So the bottom line here is that if you believe we are created male and female, and that male and female are created for each other, you will now be treated under federal civil rights law as the legal equivalent of a racist. Mm-hmm. And then we can talk about all of the concrete consequences, what this means for female sports, what this means for privacy, for safety, for medicine, for religious freedom, right? There's a whole host of kind of downstream consequences. But the very first thing to say is exactly Martin Luther King Jr.'s point, which is that man-made law, if it doesn't reflect the eternal law and the natural law, then you have an unjust law. And that's the fundamental problem with the Equality Act. And then all of the negative consequences of having an unjust law flow right from that.
Very good. Now, this bill did pass the U.S. House of Representatives. It's now being considered in the U.S. Senate. What's your prediction as to what will happen in the Senate? Does it have a chance of passing?
There's a chance, but a lot depends on what happens with the filibuster. So there was a hearing earlier this week. One of my EPPC colleagues, Mary Hassan, testified on, you know, our side of that hearing. So we were really proud that the Ethics and Policy Center could be contributing to the Senate deliberation on it. Right now, for any legislation to get out of the Senate, it requires 60 votes, and that's the legislative filibuster. If they keep that, the Equality Act doesn't go anywhere. If they get rid of it, if they modify it, then we're going to have to see how they modify it or, you know, how completely they get rid of it. And then it all depends on whether or not someone like Joe Manchin is going to support it or not. And this is why, you know, your state's pretty crucial here. It looks like you would have the two political parties divide along partisan lines, and it's a 50-50 Senate, which means the vice president would cast the deciding vote. But if someone like Manchin were to say, look, this law would undermine the right to life and would undermine pro-life conscience protections. This law would undermine female equality. This law would undermine female athletics. This law would undermine religious liberty. And therefore, I'm against it. Then you would have a 49-51 situation, right? So a lot will depend on Senator Manchin if the filibuster is removed. If the filibuster remains, then I think, at least for this Congress, it does not get out of the Senate.
Is there anything that you're recommending people to do? Should they contact their senators right now and voice their opposition to the Equality Act at this point?
Well, of course, course, it's always a good idea to be an active citizen, right? Make your voice heard, letters to the editor, phone calls, email. I mean, however you want to help educate on this issue, you should be doing it, right? Sharing essays on Facebook and Twitter. If you yourself aren't a good writer, you're not going to write a letter to the editor, share someone else's op-ed on your social media page. Be willing to have the conversation. I think one way that the other side wins is by silencing our side, by intimidating people, bullying people. That's part of what's going on here with Amazon and me, is that they're trying to make an example of me to prevent the next me from emerging. And we want to resist that, right? I to empower more people to speak out. So that would be my bottom line message for where do we go from here.
Very good, Dr. Ryan Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the good work in Washington, D.C., and let's do this again sometime.
Thank you, and happy to do that.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that we're living in confusing and challenging times where law and culture are increasingly hostile to Christian values. So how do you maintain your faith and convictions? That's a question that we're helping to answer at our Christianity and Culture conferences. The goal is to help believers understand the culture and how to respond in an effective and winsome way. And we'd love for you to join us. The first event will be on April the 29th in Lexington. For more information about the conference, go to our website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. And we look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome to Commonwealth Policy Live. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of CPC, here with Bob Scott. I'm going to talk briefly, not a very long segment, but we have something very important to talk about. It's something, Bob, that you and I have worked closely together on for a couple of months now. Christianity and Culture Conferences. The first one is coming up in Lexington on April the 29th. And we've got a great lineup of speakers. We've got a great different number of topics that we're going to cover. But Bob, tell us, if you would, is the church outreach director, the guy who is point man for CPC, working with pastors, speaking to churches, why is a conference like this necessary to begin with? Christianity and culture, why is it needed right now?
Well, obviously, Richard, we've entered into and been entering into an interesting season for a while now, and it's vitally important that churches get engaged, you know, and get involved. And we're here to encourage them, you know, and help them. And that's why this conference is so important, especially we've seen a change on the federal level with regard to the presidency. And there seems to be a lot of movement afoot that would definitely start touching upon Christian rights, you know, obviously religious freedom. These are all issues, First Amendment rights. You're also looking at the right to life, the sanctity of human life, lots and lots of issues that seem to be running in that direction. So we felt it was very important. And I got to tell you, I am super excited about these conferences. It's an amazing opportunity. And we have been able to pull together some incredible speakers. I mean, gifted speakers. I feel, Richard, some of the best speakers available within our state that have a track record and experience. You know, when you start talking about people like Bob Russell, you know, and what he's been able to do is from a ministry standpoint, you know, he took a church of around 200 people, and he's no longer at that church. He's retired, but I call him the pastor's pastor, and he's an author now. And he's you know, that church is over 30,000 people, you know, and Bob is a well-respected person, Bob Russell Ministries. We've got Pastor Robert Cunningham is another one. He's an up-and-coming pastor, you know, in the Lexington area. Angela Minter, she is the president and founder of Sisters for Life. Again, a dear sister, very well-known in our state, and on the front line dealing with the sanctity of human life and things that she's done over there. Brandon Porter, communications director for the Kentucky Baptist Convention, and Blaine Adamson, owner of hands-on originals from over in Lexington that has been in the fight and experienced the fight, has lived the fight.
Let me jump in. This is good. We've got some great speakers, but let me tee this up a little bit further as to you mentioned about the history, the moment that we're in right now that would help to propel the church to get engaged. And I want to read a quote from a CNN reporter from just over a week ago. Devin Cole was commenting on the gender identity issue. And this is what he said. And I'm sharing this with you just so you all can get a little context of where our culture is and the need for the church to engage. Devin Cole, CNN breaking news reporter, said this: "It's not possible to know a person's gender identity at birth." You heard that correctly. It's not possible to know a person's gender identity at birth. And there is no consensus criteria for assigning sex at birth. Look, Bob, if you have people who are charged with telling the truth, otherwise known as journalists, boldly asserting that gender is unidentifiable at birth, it's actually knowable, by the way, in gestation at about in the second trimester. If these people who are charged with telling the truth cannot tell us the truth on something as basic as human biology, then we're in bigger trouble than we realize.
Agreed.
Journalists are not the only people that are charged with telling us the truth, though. Pastors, even though pastors' voices have not necessarily been welcomed in the public arena, they've been marginalized, many Christians, and the Christian voice has been marginalized to a degree in our public realm. It's important that pastors realize that they are people of truth. They're people of the book. They're here to preach and to teach God's word on a regular basis. And it's important that churches, pastors in particular, find their voice when it comes to issues such as gender, such as human constraints, such as the ethical boundaries that God has put together for us. So, Bob, this is an important conference where we have these great speakers, as you just mentioned, to talk about different challenges of the church. Angela Minter is going to talk about radical compassion to elevate the sanctity of human life. Blaine Adamson is going to talk about religious freedom in the workplace. Robert Cunningham, pastor of Tate's Creek Presbyterian Church in Lexington, is going to talk about reimagining cultural engagement. Bob, here's the bottom line. If the church doesn't find its voice, if pastors do not begin to speak to these issues boldly and clearly, we're going to find ourselves in further trouble. And because God's people should love their neighbor, and it's because churches should be good community members, we need to find our voice, and we need to speak to these issues, don't we?
You can't say it any more clearly and succinctly than that, Richard, and you're 100% correct, because we are at a time such as this. You know, I almost liken it back to when the original signers to the Declaration of Independence, and by the way, approximately half of them had some kind of theological training when they were signing that document, that this is a time, you know, that we can't sit on our hands and remain on the sideline. It's very important, you know, that we do it in a loving way, but we, and you say it often, we have to land on the truth. It's absurd, you know, that the Bible as a Christian very clearly states that God created them male and female. And there isn't such a thing as multiple genders at all.
Yeah, if I could jump in, you know, when it comes to something as basic as gender, to you and me and many of the people watching right now, it does seem obvious. But in a post-truth world, and that's where we are right now, post-truth was the word of the year 5 years ago. And that means that emotions or personal beliefs have more weight than objective facts.
Yes.
And when you live in a post-truth world where I can define my own reality, why? Because my heart or my emotions tell me that I really feel this way, really feel strongly. When you are in that place, there really is no room, or not a lot of room, for agreed upon objective transcendent truth. And that's what we're facing today.
Yes.
I'm reminded, so you mentioned the founding fathers, Bob. I'll go back a little further. To 2,700 years ago, the prophet Isaiah talked about truth. You know, he warned the Israelites against idol worship.
And he warned them that if they worship idols, they'll become like them. Mouths that don't speak, ears that don't hear, eyes that don't see. In other words, people ensnared in idol worship become something less than human. And when you begin to worship yourself or your own opinions, and I think that's what we're talking about in this post-truth world, you're going to become something less than human. And it's being demonstrated to us today where the where you can't, you know, if your strong feelings trump clear objective biology, you're becoming something less than human. Yeah. Here's what Isaiah said, though. He said this in chapter 59. Justice is turned back, and righteousness stands far away, for truth has stumbled in the public squares, and uprightness cannot enter. Truth is lacking, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. Bob, truth is stumbling in our streets. It's stumbling in the public square, and I submit to you that unless people of truth begin articulating the truth, unless people of truth begin walking out their lives in the truth, unless pastors speak truth as it relates to our lives on a daily basis, unless that happens, we will fall into darkness. Truth will continue to stumble in the streets, in the public squares. And I would submit, Bob, that our culture is crying out for people of truth to stand in the gap. Our society needs people of truth more than ever, doesn't it?
Amen. Amen. And Isaiah also said, in, I believe, chapter 5, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. You know, it's almost like the natural realm has been turned upside down, you know. And it is important, Richard, that right now, in a time that we now find ourselves in, that we are going to land on the truth and speak it in love, but speak it, you know.
That's right. Bob, so to that saying, you often hear us hear, and many of the listeners hear us, have heard us say, we lead with grace, but we land on truth. We're careful to the people we're speaking to. We want to be gracious and kind to them. We're always, always, always going to land on the truth. And in this day and age, we need to be very careful. When it comes to gender identity issues, there are real people struggling with this. We do not mean to harm. We don't mean to offend. No. But we believe that our Creator has made us male and female, and that we do best when we embrace our biological born gender identity. The world is desperately looking for truth. It's desperately looking for healing in a time of brokenness. And that's what the conference is going to talk about.